You're listening to episode 2 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hi guys, this is a temporary placeholder for the perfect sponsor. I'm excited to partner with a company that I genuinely believe in and stand firmly by their message and products. If you're interested in sponsoring my show and you believe your brand can truly be of value and of service to me and my tribe, reach out to me on my contact page at 88cupsoftea.com and let's chat.
Hey everyone, guess who we have? We have Colleen McGinnis. She's a fabulous writer that I worked with on her TV show called NBC's Love Bites. She's a wonderful human being and I'm so excited to have her here. And she's also a fellow Long Islander. So welcome, Colleen. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. We're so excited to have you. Yeah, same.
And so let's get started. How did you specifically get into writing for TV?
Well, you know, I signed with a feature agent when I first started out, and features take forever. And I was working as an assistant at the time over at New Line Cinema, and I had so many student loans. I had so many credit card bills. I was just in debt, and I really needed to find a job, and I wanted that job to be writing. And so I finally asked, could I get a TV agent? And I did. And a certain number of months later, I started on my first show. It was a show for NBC called Mismatch, which Darren Star produced. It starred Alicia Silverstone. And unfortunately, it didn't last very long, but it was a great learning experience. And I saw my first paycheck come for writing, which was really exciting.
Wow, that's awesome. So let's backtrack a little bit. I'm really curious. What attracted you to writing? When did you know that you wanted to write?
You know, I remember being in second grade and asking my mom if I could start a journal. And I don't know where I got that idea from, but she said, okay. And she found a notebook in the house and said, why don't you start with that? And I just started journaling and writing stories. And it was just something that I felt compelled to do from a pretty young age. You know, when I was like five, I would write stories down and I was probably a lot of spelling errors, but I always had that sort of urge and desire to get things down on paper and to tell stories. And so it was just something I always did that I always loved doing. And I think it's, you know, partially because I always love reading. And I feel like a lot of people who are writers, most of us really love to read.
So were you basically laser focused and you knew right away that you wanted to be a writer and you kind of focused on those subjects in high school and eventually led you to going to college? And did you specifically choose a writing major?
I was not laser focused at all.
I wonder who is at that age, honestly.
Yeah, not me. I like your version of the story better than what actually happened.
We'll stick to that one. I'm kidding.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, English was always my favorite subject. It always felt like that came easier to me than certainly math or science, and even though I'm half Asian. So I always gravitated towards that, but certainly in high school, I remember my dad telling me that I might have a problem down the road because I was doing so many different activities, and he would advise me, you should really try to pick one. And at the time, I just thought, oh, no, that's so boring. I loved sports and I loved theater and all that stuff was exciting to me. And so I didn't really focus until probably midway through college.
Oh, so in college, what did you claim your major as when you first went in?
Well, my concentration was English and we did have to decide pretty early, but I didn't know what I wanted to do with that. And that's sort of the problem with being an English concentrator is that there's no like real set career path. It's like, unless you definitely want to be a teacher or a professor, yeah. It's a little bit daunting. Like, what do you do with this degree? And is it a waste of time and all of that? But I just knew that to get your English degree, you were essentially reading a lot of books, which just sounded great to me. But midway through my sophomore year, there was a program at school called the externship program. It was through Radcliffe College. And essentially what it was a program over spring break that allowed undergraduates to follow a female professional for just a week and see what their professional lives were like. And a lot of times it was, you could follow a judge or a lawyer or, you know, a scientist. And that one year, word got around that there was a film director who you could follow. And so I applied and got the externship. And they very generously flew me out to Los Angeles. And I lived with a director named Claudia Weil, family. And that was like the big life changer for me, because Claudia really became my mentor and was the first person to really say, you can do this if you want. You can write and direct. You can work in film. You can work in TV. You have to come out to Los Angeles. It's a lot easier to find a job out here. She introduced me to so many fantastic and talented people. And the whole week was just like some kind of fever dream. You know, she would just drop me off on a set. We would have dinner with directors I really admired. The first night I got there, we went to a taping of Friends, which at the time was, you know, huge. It was one of my favorite shows. And from Long Island, I was not exposed to any of this. And it helped me finally get a focus, because I realized, oh, this is what I want to do with this degree, and this is what I want to do after college. And when I met all these people, I asked them, what should I do? And they said, you know, you should start writing and you should start directing theater. And, you know, whatever is available to you at college, take advantage of it. So that's what I started doing. And that's when I had a goal in front of me finally.
So you dabbled in directing as well then?
Yeah. The first show I directed at college when I got back from that externship, my junior year, I directed A Doll's House by Ibsen. And then I put up a big sort of splashy old-fashioned musical, which they weren't really doing at my college at the time. I directed Guys and Dolls, and so much fun. Yeah, I loved it. And, you know, there's a little bit of comedy in that, and I'm a big musicals fan. And then when I came out to Los Angeles, the first thing I ever wrote was a comedic short film that I also directed. And it was that with a feature that I wrote, what got me my first agent and my first job, you know, writing for Mismatch.
Wow. So how did you get your work to that agent, though? Did you just have guns out blazing? You just started sending it out to all different agencies? Or did you know somebody? Or was it maybe the mentor that you had the externship with that passed it along to somebody that she knew?
Well, it's always a little tricky. People often ask me how to find an agent. And it's always a hard question, because I feel like there's not really one answer. You know, you just want to try to do work and get it out there. And I always advise people that if you're giving someone a script to read, to make sure that it's really great, not just good. And that's the advice that I got. But it doesn't mean rewrite something for 10 years, but essentially make it as good as it can be. So when I was an assistant at New Line, I started writing a feature script at night after work, you know, and on the weekends. And I was also shooting the short. And when I had those two things, I gave them to essentially other assistants who were working just like me and trying to get to a better place. And we were all working these terrible hours and scrambling and paying off our loans. And some of those people wanted to become managers and agents. And some of those people wanted to try to get noticed by finding material. So it sort of worked to my benefit. I just gave these pieces of material to my friends and asked for feedback. And they responded and sort of handed them upwards. So eventually the stuff got into the hands of different managers, and I finally signed with a management company, and then they took me on the rounds and I met with a bunch of different agents. They responded to the material and then eventually picked one and signed with them.
On that note, I was actually wondering too, how important do you think it is to nourish and build relationships with those around you, like in terms of networking as a writer and a director?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. It's very important. Networking is such a hard word, because to me, it always brought up this like sort of negative connotation, because it feels like this kind of false dynamic that you're having, right? Where it's like I'm networking, you know, it feels like so sort of like fake to me. But essentially, you know, that is what people are doing. I think I've tried, though, to, instead of framing it as networking, to truly find people who I connect with, who I think are doing exciting things, who are being creative, who are like-minded. We can have a discussion about movies where we're both excited to talk about the same films. All those things are really attractive to me, and other people are motivated and following through. And then I feel like you just start to form those connections naturally versus that harder version of networking. And it's such a fine line, because it's so good to get out into the world and to go on meetings and to meet folks. That's a really important part of this business. And on the other hand, I don't think I've ever gotten something, and I don't think I've ever, like, it's through anything that was strictly networking where it was like, oh, you know, you should just know this person because they're going to help you. So I think it's really always about, you have a genuine connection, you have something in common with this person, and to let it build naturally from there. Because I think that people gravitate towards people like them, and it's important to send your feelers out and find your community. So certainly get out there, but I always advise, make sure it's a natural connection and that it's a natural endeavor, because a lot of people need help and need jobs and this and that. And I think people respond more towards someone who is a little more authentic, right?
Yes, I agree. And I thank you for that because I feel like you're right. It's a hard word to work around, networking. Yeah. It comes off really negative because of all the stereotypes coming along with it. You think schmoozing and all that. But
yeah,
with the way you put it, it's so important. Like, people need to understand, like, you just have to go in it with authentic and genuine intentions,
yeah,
knowing that you want to add to this community and not just take, 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 take. And
right,
when you think about
exactly,
it, you're kind of building your own family, your own tribe in a way where it's like, we're all in this together. Let's all rise together. Why not? And I personally would rather work with someone that I know has really good intentions, kind intentions. I see that they're always doing their best and working their hardest. If I had a position, I would want to offer that person that position because at least I have things in common. I know them already. And I know they have not stopped working hard and it's about time because
right,
they deserve it. That was really important the way you put it. So thank you for that, Colleen.
Yeah, no, of course. And you put it in a good way too, where, you know, it is about not just like trying to get something. And that's almost like the better piece of advice is that whatever early job you have, try to be really helpful. You know, like, mm-hmm, that was a huge way that I met people is that, you know, when you're an assistant, you need favors and you ask for favors. And if you're that person who is known to be resourceful, if people call you and you can help them, you can point them towards someone else, or you can provide an answer, if you'll take that extra step to make a phone call for them, that is building up a certain kind of network because people start coming to you knowing that they can
count on you, basically.
Yeah, that they can count on you. And then, you know, when your time comes for a big favor, you know, you can ask them.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel so awkward. It's literally,
right,
it's like, well, it's the same thing like helping out a brother and sister. It's like, okay, just think of it that way. And I think,
yep,
a lot of people have that problem asking for favors because they forget,
yeah,
you always have to try to help first. And honestly, even if that person in the long run doesn't help you in the end, it's okay. It's good karma. You know,
yep,
you did something good paying it forward. Great.
Totally.
You know, you just
totally
never know. And so thank you for that. I love that. And I think the listeners would really appreciate that.
Sure.
What kind of genres that are you usually drawn to for TV writing?
For TV writing, you know, I started out writing, you know, like I said, for that show Mismatch, which really was sort of a light comedic tone. But at the time, they weren't really doing half hour single camera shows. So it was a 1 hour. And because that was my first show, I started out on this 1 hour track. And I didn't realize that that meant that I would continue to go up for 1 hour shows. And so I did that for a while, but I was always very interested in comedy and doing some feature work in comedy as well. And it was the show that we worked on together, Love Bites,
yeah,
you know, I was a co-producer on it, and it didn't last very long either, but, you know, loved working with you, obviously. And
oh, I loved working with you too. And listen, it's amazing that it got picked up, and you know how competitive it is. So that's something to be super proud of. So yay,
well,
it's awesome.
Wasn't my show. I just got hired on it. You know,
still, it's still a job. It's amazing. So
it's always good to have a job. Yeah,
exactly.
But the reason I bring up Love Bites is because that show was actually run like a comedy. And what I mean by that is there was a rewrite / punch up room, and there was a story room, and it was run by people who had worked in half hour. And it was a different process than what I had experienced on 1 hour shows. And I really liked that collaboration. I really liked the emphasis on comedy. I liked punching up jokes. I liked telling those kinds of comedic stories. And the year after, I was able to switch genres, essentially. And I wrote a comedy spec that was a half hour. And I told my agents, I want to write in the half hour space. And so my next job was 30 Rock. And I've pretty much stayed in the comedy genre since then.
That's amazing. Now, that leads us into 30 Rock, which obviously a lot of our listeners, if not all, know about the show, and that is so huge. So tell us a little bit about 30 Rock and how it's like working on a show that's been running for so long. Like, do you ever feel like that you have to stick to a very strict kind of outline of where the characters are going, or because you guys have such a huge following, do you kind of take in what fans say, like really hard shippers, as they call it? Do you kind of write to what they would like to see happen? Or did you guys already have like an end story that you kind of knew how you were going to weave it all the way to the end?
Well, it's a good question because 30 Rock was the first show that I worked on that was already up and running, and it was such a well-oiled machine by the time I got there. You know, I wrote for the last two seasons, season 6 and season 7, and it's a totally different ballgame to come into a show that already is versus starting from the ground floor. I think, you know, as a writer, it's a challenge because certainly I had seen every single episode of 30 Rock at least once, but I still decided to review the episodes as much as I could. I didn't have a lot of time to do it, but I wanted to make sure I knew what had already been done just so that I was not pitching something that they had done in season 2. And still, that could still happen because there were tons of pitches that were made that didn't make it onto the screen. So part of it is making sure that you're not repeating something. Part of it is associating yourself with what kinds of stories you can tell for each character. Certainly, the stories that you pitch for Liz are different than the stories that you pitch for Tracy, which are different than the stories you pitch for Jenna. Each character has their own voice and often a joke structure, you know, or joke structures really that go along with that character. And it's all about trying to be aware of what goes well for each character and how all of these things together form an episode. So there was a lot of essentially playing catch up. It was a big learning curve to come into a show like that, especially one that's so complicated. And so certainly in the beginning, I pitched as much as I could, but I also was really listening and just trying to make sure I understood how the show was run and, you know, what was expected of me and trying to get to know the other writers. And so it's a very, very different process. But in terms of listening to what the fans want, I don't know if that was ever the hugest priority. I think that everyone was very grateful that 30 Rock had such hardcore fans and a very devoted following. And so I believe that there was always a healthy respect for the audience. Like, everyone was grateful that they were watching 30 Rock. But I don't know that people were necessarily trolling the message boards. Maybe people would look and see how people were reacting to certain episodes. But I think it's different to react to a fan's comments for a comedy versus if you write on a show like Lost, people are demanding certain things in terms of serialized drama. Maybe you have to listen to that a little bit more, maybe not. But I wouldn't say that it was the hugest priority. At the same time, I think certainly everyone wanted the audience to be happy, and we certainly kept that in mind as we came up with the finale. You know, like, we knew, for example, that there had to be a big Jack and Liz scene at the end. That was the other big learning curve too, was to be on a show that was ending. And how do you land that plane? And how do you write the final 13 episodes? And how do you pick a finale? And all of that. And so that was a really sort of wonderful experience, just in terms of hearing everyone's thoughts and what each character meant to them and what they wanted to see for these characters, and to sort of combine that and do the best that we could in terms of both what, you know, we wanted as the writers and what we hoped would satisfy all those loyal fans.
Wow. So that's actually quite interesting, because I know some shows, the creators already are, I've heard a few shows have done this where they know exactly how each characters would end up. Like, exactly to the T, and they kind of hope that it'll last till whatever season to make it happen. So yours sounds a lot like you just kind of went with the flow, and see, like, that's really cool, because you have a lot more creative freedom in that way. I feel like there's a lot more responsibility handed to you guys to kind of just create your own fantasy and how it would end. So that's quite nice, actually. I like hearing that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we were taking our cues from Tina and Robert Carlock, who ran the show with Tina, you know, to see where they wanted things to go. But, you know, they were very open and they wanted to hear our thoughts. And Tina made the suggestion at some point when we were watching some Amish reality show during lunch. Hey, maybe we should watch some classic finales instead, you know, because we still didn't know what we were doing for the finale. And I think that was really helpful. You know, we watched Mary Tyler Moore and Frasier and Cheers. And nice. Most of us, I think, had seen these finales before. But to watch them in, you know, context of here's what they did, what should we do, what worked for them, what's going to be important to us, that was also a really good learning experience. And, you know, I think that we all tried to look at it not just as writers, but as fans. Like, what would you want to see happen for Liz Lemon? And what do you want to see happen for Jack? And it was a really fun exercise to do.
Yeah, and it makes it so much more exciting to go to work every single day, because you're so pumped up about it and trying to figure it out. How was that like, going into a job environment where everyone was already so close? Like, I'm like trying to think of it myself, where when I went on to the show for Gossip Girl, everyone was already
tight-knit and they were so close. And I came in towards season one. And that, for me, felt like a lot of pressure where, if anything, I wish I let loose a little bit more. I was so like on my A game that I was so scared to even like laugh at times, you know, because my first big job. Was it similar for you where it's like, oh my gosh, like they're already a family and it's like me trying to like fit in or just like be a part of this family as well? Or did it just come naturally?
No, I mean, it was totally intimidating. You know, it's like 30 Rock was my favorite comedy. I loved it so much. I had so much respect for Tina Fey and Robert and all these writers for creating what they had done. And to come into that is certainly a process. And at the same time, it was in my head certainly that, look, you know, they're paying me. I have to contribute. You know, I can't just sit here and be scared and silent. And at the same time, you want to have some reverence for people who certainly know the show way better than I do and know what's expected. And so it is a little bit of a challenging balancing act when you first start on something like that. And certainly when I first started, everyone was so nice, but also so smart and so funny. And you're just trying to play catch up, I think, in the beginning. And then socially, sure, it's hard. Everyone already has a whole bank of memories and private jokes. But I will say that the staff was so generous in terms of sharing these things. You know, I wasn't the only new writer that year. There were four of us who started in season six together. And I think they got kind of a kick out of saying, look, we love this YouTube video. Here's this game we play. Here's this tradition we have. They were excited to share it with us too.
That's really cool that they're so inclusive. I love hearing that.
Yeah.
That's really, do you notice a pattern if there's like just from working from drama and comedy, both of those genres, if it's more comfortable to work with a comedic environment, do you feel like that kind of seeps into the real life behind scenes, or is it the same where everyone's personality comes out no matter what, whether it's drama, whether it's comedy? Because I would think working on a show that's hilarious, everyone would be so much fun and so welcoming and so inviting, you know? And I feel like with drama, it's like, oh, okay, we got to talk about murder now. And how are we going to kill off this character? You know, it's like, doesn't really leave room in my mind, I would think, for laughter.
Well, I think that it's a good question. I think that it really starts at the top, and it's really about the tone that the showrunner sets. And if they are a humorous, comedic person, it doesn't matter if it's a drama or a comedy, you know, because I've certainly had some really fun times on dramas too. It's all about the tone that's put forth, and the staff kind of follows. It's all about the other people that are hired. What is everyone's personality types? Because often, I would say that shows probably have something in common in terms of the type of people that they're looking for, and just a certain vibe just starts to kind of grow. But that being said, I think that probably overall comedy rooms are more fun. There's more laughing because that's part of the process. It's okay to go off on tangents and to tell funny stories and to do bits in the room and watch videos because it's all part of it. It could all lead to a joke or a story. Whereas in drama, you know, that might be a little bit less common. I don't know if people need to be telling funny stories that need to go into the show, but sometimes. And sometimes it's just a nice break.
Yeah.
So, but ultimately, I really think it is about the creator and the showrunner, what kind of tone that they are setting.
Oh, well, that's exciting. That's pretty cool. Thank you for sharing that with us, Colleen. I'd love to bring us back a little bit backtrack to talking about mentors. I know you mentioned you had that amazing one through your externship.
Yeah.
And what is the best advice you've ever received, whether it's through that mentor that you had or through someone else, maybe a boss or someone you worked with, a coworker or family member that you think would help our listeners to apply to our own careers and lives?
Well, there are a few things. I mean, in terms of finding a job, I remember Claudia, my mentor and the woman I lived with during the externship, I remember looking for a job and her advice was to end up in a high traffic situation. And she didn't mean stand in the middle of the street. She meant, you know, try to work at an agency or a studio or a network or a place where essentially you're having a lot of contact with a good cross-section of people, and versus just working for a producer in an office where maybe you don't see as many people. And I think, of course, look, that's a general piece of advice. If you want to go work for Spielberg and maybe you're sitting in his office, maybe that's okay. But essentially, I thought that was a great piece of advice. And that's one of the reasons why I took that job at New Line, because I had a feeling that I would interface with a lot of different folks, which was the case. And that kind of goes back to your question earlier of how important is networking. And obviously, if you meet a lot of people, there's a greater chance that some of those people will be able to help you out. And, you know, another piece of advice I got when I was starting out was don't work for an asshole. There are too many nice people in the industry, so it's not worth it. And I thought that was important too, because there's some really horrible, abusive people in this industry. And there are also some really lovely, smart, fantastic people. And you might not get your dream job right away, but if you're working for a nice person, that's going to be beneficial for you, because at some point you're going to leave that job and that person's going to become a reference. And that person can help you find that next thing. And you want someone who potentially would mentor you and help you along the way versus someone who is going to be awful.
And also, so, I feel like it's a reflection on you too, as a mentee. Because for me, I would think, oh, he worked for that guy. I heard he's kind of like really mean and kind of a douchebag. Yeah. I would think he probably trained this kid and probably brainwashed him to work the same exact way and would like go around snapping at people or whatever. So I would be less inclined to work with that person. But if I heard they worked with, let's say with you, I'm like, oh, I've worked with Colleen myself. She's so loving. She's got such a warm energy. Absolutely. So I know that that would seep into the mentee. And that is someone I would much rather work with just from association. So it's really also a reflection on that mentee as well. So yeah, definitely a very helpful advice. Yeah, it's not only saving yourself stress, but also face, I guess you can kind of say.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sort of like, be careful who you hang out with, like your friends are a reflection on you. And
absolutely.
The flip of it is that in Hollywood, certainly surviving certain producers with bad tempers is also seen as a badge of honor. And some of those people aren't jerks, but they just put up with a really, really horrible job. And that makes them seem really tough and thick-skinned. And you know,
yes, I could see it that way too. You're right. You're absolutely right about that.
But I don't think it's worth it. And then in terms of career stuff, one piece of advice I got, and this really goes for all of life, I think, is the saying, go where it's warm. And I really like that. And it's similar in a way to don't work for an asshole. But it's essentially, look, it's like hang out with friends who make you feel good. Date people who are good to you. Mm. Take the job that really feels right to you in your gut. And if something doesn't seem to be working out, and I'm not saying get discouraged and quit, but you know what it is. It's like that intuitive feeling of this isn't quite right. Oh, but it's paying a lot of money, or oh, it's a short commute, or it's a higher title. If you don't feel right about it, don't take it. You want to find people who are like-minded, who are on the same wavelength as you, want to feel good about what you're doing. And then I feel like money, et cetera, all of that comes. And to me, it's all about going with the flow. And I just liked that idea of go where it's warm.
Like a phrase that kind of rings in my mind right now. It's kind of like choose to be happy. You can choose your own path. So
absolutely.
I feel like we're kind of going through this whole generation right now where this kind of like a spiritual revolution, I guess you can kind of say, where it's my parents' generation is very much of what could they do to give their family face. But I feel like our generation now, it's more about what can I do so that I can be happy and proud of myself and that my kids will be proud of me. Mm-hmm. And in the end of the day, I will realize, yes, it's important to succeed in your career, but it's even more important to keep those that you love around you and to not sacrifice job over what's really important, which is family, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, you have to prioritize.
Absolutely. I'm curious now about when Claudia mentioned to work in a place where it's high traffic.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. And so for those people who, I'm sure it's really, really competitive to get jobs, whether it's at an agency or a high traffic production company, and they end up having to pay bills. We all understand that. So they might have to grab a job, whatever they can, let's say at a coffee shop, just as a very generic example. What advice would you give them if they have, I kind of don't like to use the word no other choice, but let's just say they really tried their best and they could not get any other opening or position or job for high traffic position, something that's related to their career, and they were only able to get a job outside of that, but it's able to pay the bills.
Yeah, I think there's two ways to answer that question. I think one is to keep trying to get a job in the industry, because essentially, I think that can be very, very helpful in terms of, yeah, like you were saying earlier, connections, and also getting your work seen, because you can do the work, but you have to give it to people and get it out there. And there's also a lot to learn about the industry. I think it's really helpful to see how it works. And if you're a writer, to read a bunch of scripts, good and bad, and to go to test screenings and just to see what this industry is about. So I would say that if you're working in a coffee shop, you keep sending your resume out, because if you leave a coffee shop after a month, it's going to be fine. It's not the end of the world. It's not like you've accepted a teaching position and then you're leaving everyone in the lurch.
Yeah.
You have that freedom. And the second part is, though, that working in a coffee shop, the flip is that it can be a good thing for you creatively. When I left New Line, I had signed with an agent and I was going out on meetings and all of that. And I purposely wanted a job that was not in the industry because I wanted to really focus on my writing and not have the really long hours and the other sort of distractions of working an industry job. So I worked at a restaurant for a few months before I started on my first show. And there's something about that too, where you're just not thinking about Hollywood at all. And you're interfacing with real life, which I think is very important, especially for a writer, to be meeting different kinds of people and experiencing different things. And
hearing all these characters and stories.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you have to get out there. So sometimes it's good to not be in the middle of Hollywood, you know, to just see regular people interact with each other. So that can also be very helpful.
Oh, so I love that. You're so positive. I love that.
That's so encouraging though, seriously, because there's so many listeners out there, so many of us out here where it's like, we all understand it's so important. You have to pay the bills. You have to, you know, priorities. Yeah. And it can get tough. Like I have so many friends who love this industry so much, but then they're getting torn between like the family stressing, like, you're getting older now, you should be settling down, you should be coming back home, this, that. And it's like, okay, well, let me just give myself a shot. Let me just grab this job and like do this. I can't do a 9-to-5 job outside this industry because it might suck their soul and end up giving up completely. Yeah. So it is so nice to hear that it's sometimes a refreshing break to have a job as a waitress or working in a coffee shop or whether it's a Lyft driver or anything now that they have now, you know, or a courier. And because that's your time where it's like stepping outside of the industry, getting your creative juices flowing. And like we were just mentioning, collecting stories, meeting all these cool people that might inspire you for your next feature film or something. You never know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's about always keeping your goals in mind, no matter where you are. Because even if you are working at a coffee shop, it's like you can come home and you can watch some movies from the 70s that you haven't seen. You can always come home and start outlining your next film. You know, it's like you can do a character bio off of somebody that you just met.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. You're just reframing your experience and seeing how it can help you. Because essentially telling stories, it's just about taking your interpretations of life, right, and putting them down on paper to some degree. Mm-hmm. So you can do that wherever you are. And I think that it's so hard. It's so easy to want to give up. This business can be incredibly challenging and it's really, really hard to break in. But I think that if people really, really want to do this above anything else, they'll hang in there.
Working your jobs and you still came home and you're working at odd hours just to get your feature film script done. Like, that's a living example right there, proof that you did it. You know, you were able to do it. So there's really, not to sound like harsh tiger mom, but there's no other excuse, to be honest. You know, if you want to make it, you've got to really go the length.
Absolutely.
And, you know, don't complain about it because if this is what you love, you're going to go home no matter how tired as hell you are. You're like, yes, I can't wait to put those words on that screen.
Totally.
You know?
That's what my mom would say to me, like when I would complain and she'd be like, well, you don't have to do it. It's your choice. And it's like, oh that is true.
this is what I'm choosing to do.
Yeah. And I think too, there's this sort of common misbelief of if I just had all day and all night to write, I'd get so much done. It's so helpful to have a structure. And most of the people I know, they all had to work jobs and they would just write on the side. That's how we all started. We'd all write until 1 in the morning.
Oh yeah, because the daily job that's putting food on the table is pushing them and motivating them to get the hell out of there.
Exactly.
It's like, I don't want to keep doing this for the rest of my life.
That's how I felt. Yeah,
exactly.
I loved my boss at New Line and it was a great place to work. But after a certain point, I was like, I can't stay here anymore.
I love that. How do you keep your creative juices flowing? Maybe share what your habits are, whether it's like going home, any time that you have free, do you read scripts, a lot of scripts? And if you do, what kind of advice can you give to listeners where they can find access to great scripts or whichever scripts that you recommend, or if they should be watching more TV shows and movies? What do you advise?
Get your juices flowing, as you say. I like to kind of fill the tank, like that saying that sometimes I'll do a lot of writing and there will be a lot of output and then I'll feel kind of drained. Like I just don't have anything else. And so I will just take a little bit of time to, yeah, read a great book. Or sometimes I'll read about writing. Like I just read Ray Bradbury's Zen and the Art of Writing. And it's essentially a collection of his essays where he just talks about how much he loves to write. And it's so cute. It's lovely. It's adorable. It's just so infectious. And he's just so excited about it. And it got me re-inspired. I wouldn't say I watch a ton of television, but I do watch a decent amount. I'm just kind of picky about what I watch. But all the shows, I feel like at this point, it kind of to some degree ruins the magic, right? But it's like, yes. I am looking at them in terms of how they're structured or for their comedies, kind of jokes and stories are they telling and how did they do that scene and what would have made that episode better or worse or all these things. And it's like, I can't just relax and watch a TV show.
I know,
show
it's
anymore.
A blessing and a curse, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and I don't mean to do it. And I truly try to just enjoy shows. And I think that's why sometimes dramas are more enjoyable for me to watch at this point because I'm not paying as much attention to the mechanics of it. Because whereas with comedies, sometimes I really feel like I can just see the mechanics too much and it's not as enjoyable. But that being said, I still love comedy and I love to laugh. And yeah, and it's the same thing with movies. I feel like, yeah, like watch as many great movies as you can. And some of those movies are old. I feel like a lot of the best movies were made a long time ago. I try to stay current and watch things that are good now, of course. But it's also about digging into subjects that interest you. And a lot of stuff has already been done. And why not learn from that? I don't really read a lot of script. That's not high on my list, unless I have to. Certainly for staffing season, you're reading a lot of different pilots and things like that. Or friend scripts, giving them notes. It's not an enjoyable process. I do not enjoy reading scripts, to be honest. No. I think it's hard. It's not fun. But it can be a helpful learning experience. And I will say that starting out, it's important to do. And when I wrote my first feature, I certainly was looking at other feature scripts that were in a similar genre. You know, like I was writing sort of like a lighter drama, and I remember reading the script for You Can Count on Me, which was a movie I really loved, and a heavier drama, which was Ordinary People, but it was about a family, and so was my script. And I learned a lot. I mean, these scripts are fantastic. So that is something that can be very helpful.
I love that. Thank you. You mentioned just now a little bit about during pilot season, that's uh-huh. where you read the scripts. Could you walk us a little bit through pilot season, through your eyes, and how you go into pilot season? Because I know that you've been working on a pilot. Can you share a little bit about it as much as you can, and if whatever you're comfortable with our listeners?
Sure. Well, there's like a couple different versions of what pilot season really is. If you're staffing, that's when I'm reading a lot of scripts because I'm seeing what's out there and what's getting picked up. And is there anything that I would want to potentially put my hat in for, you know, in terms of being hired on a show. But then in terms of writing pilots, that happens obviously earlier. And, you know, right now I'm working on a pilot for FX. Matt Damon and Ben Affleck's company are producing. And it's my first cable pilot, which I'm really excited about.
So exciting. Congratulations,
yeah, cool.
by the
Thank
way.
You.
That's and so awesome.
Thanks. But it's a totally different process for cable and one that I'm still learning. But I've done two network pilots. And the process is essentially, for me, I decided to work with a studio first and then started to pitch an idea or ideas to the studio. And once we found one, I hooked up with a producer. And sometimes my first pilot, I hooked up with the producer first, coming up with the fully fleshed out idea.
So there was no agency involved with this. It was all through you and the people that you knew, sort of.
No, the agency is definitely involved. The first pilot I did, it started out very organically where Tina had asked me when 30 Rock ended if I had any ideas, and I pitched her an idea.
You're like, hell yeah, I do.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, sure. Scrambling through notebooks. Yeah, but I did have one idea, and luckily she responded to it. And then at the same time, my agents were setting me up on meetings with studios, and I landed on a studio, and it was also the studio where Tina has a deal so that potentially we could work together. And so Tina and I started talking about this idea, and I was also translating that to the studio. So that was a really sort of nice organic experience because it all worked out. Tina was someone I had worked with before and all of that. And then this year was just a little bit of a different process. I decided to work with that studio again. I pitched them a few different ideas. We landed on one, and then I found producers. So all these things can happen in different order, but certainly agents are very key in terms of setting up people for you to work with and all of that. But though sometimes you depend solely on relationships you've already built. But essentially what happens is once you land on an idea, you start to write up a pitch. And I remember when I started out just thinking like, what is that? You know, like it's so daunting and no one really tells you what it is. And it's not like you can turn on the TV and see how someone pitched that show that's on.
Exactly. It's kind of like a black hole. Like, you read about it, but then you have really no idea once you're in the room. You're just kind of tossed in there. You're just like, oh, what do I say now? Or how do I say this? That's the nerve-wracking part, which I'm like wondering, did you read books on how to pitch, or did you have mentors saying, hey, this is how I did it? Or you kind of just figured it out?
Essentially, the studio gave me like a rough idea of like, yeah, you know, talk a little bit about the premise and introduce the characters and talk about some future episodes and the arc of the series. I think they kind of throw out some guidelines, and then you start to fill in those pieces of the puzzle. And that part is up to you as the writer. What is the show about? What is the premise in one sentence? How do I relate to it? I think it's always good to have some kind of personal connection and some way into the show that you connect with. And then, yeah, you know, so much of TV and comedy is characters and talking about who your characters are and making sure they're memorable and specific. And then, yeah, like I said, launching into some future episodes, maybe talking about the pilot a little bit, talking about the future arcs for the show, for the characters, where you see it going in season three. And I think that every studio and every network, they probably have different expectations for a pitch. They're all probably roughly on the same page, but Warner Brothers might ask you to pitch differently. You know, I've heard that they ask you to bring in a big board and go through it that way. So, you know, I only have my limited experience pitching through Universal, but essentially you just want to know what the show is. And the other piece of advice is to be as prepared as you can. I type everything up. I mean, I have like a whole script essentially, and it doesn't mean I can't go off script, but I want to know what I'm going to say. And to prepare also means to rehearse and to perform it. And all these things are really helpful, because when you get in that room and the entire network is sitting there listening, it's extremely intimidating. So all you can do is stick to the script that everyone has already signed off on, that you feel good about. You can just tell them about the show, and then the result is out of your hands.
Yeah, I'm actually so happy you touched on that as well, because I am so curious. I wonder if it's very much like an audition for an actor where they don't say like you need to memorize it, but you,
you kind of should.
You know what I'm saying? Absolutely. Like, it just looks better. It looks like you're so much more interested and invested in what it is that you're doing. And for me, I just wonder with the pitches, like, do writers, or do you know for yourself or any friends, do they go in with maybe kind of like a persona, like a business persona where they go in? I wonder, do they like hearing more of a conversational pitch, or is it more of like a boom, come in, ooh, it's Colleen in the room, get out of the way, like, this is what I gotta say.
Yeah. Or is it like... I think it's like, you have to be a version of yourself, right? Like, so much of what the show is gonna be partially you and your outlook on life. And so I feel like they should get to know you, and you should show them a little bit about who you are. And, you know, that means do a little bit of chit-chat at the beginning and make sure the show is expressing your point of view and your humor and all of that stuff. But essentially, yeah, I mean, I can really only be yourself, right? And everyone's different, you know? I'm sure a zillion different personalities walk in, and who knows what works best. I mean, essentially, it is putting on a show, so you do want to put some energy into it, and that can be really hard for writers.
The best version of you.
Yeah, the best version of you, but that can be tricky, for most writers are not actors necessarily, and we're more comfortable writing. And so, you know, I used to really dread pitching when I started out, because I thought, well, I'd rather just hand them my written version of what the show is. Like, I'm a writer. Here you go. I don't want to like do a big song and dance, but that is what you have to do a little bit. And I think that's okay. You know, and I think that it's just with practice and experience, it gets easier and easier. And I've also heard of amazing writers reading directly from the page, not looking up and not making eye contact, but still selling the show. It's a great idea. Wow. And they're a great writer. Wonderful. So,
and they're enthusiastic readers. There you go.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you totally comfortable now when you pitch, or do you still get a little nervous?
Oh, I still get nervous for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
That's inspiring though. That feels good. It's like, it's okay, guys. Don't worry about it. Like, everybody feels like that, no matter how pro you are.
Yeah, you're putting yourself out there. You're making yourself vulnerable, and you don't know how they're going to respond. And different rooms have different vibes. Some networks are really gregarious and enthusiastic and laugh and make it easy on you. And other networks, you know, are quiet and don't give a lot, you know, and it's if they're a harder audience to play to. So you just have to proceed with it no matter what. Yeah.
Thank you for that, Colleen. I know you've helped us so much with career advice, and it's been so helpful. And I know the listeners are probably super pumped about this.
Oh,
and
good.
I feel like we touched a lot about career, and it's really important for me. I want the listeners to also understand how important it is to, as well, balance in family. So can we talk a little bit about that? I know you gave us a lot of time already, so I'm going to try to wrap it up real quick. Yeah. But I wanted to ask, how do you balance your career? Because you're so super busy and you're like so kick ass at what you do. And like, how do you make time for your loved ones, your fiance, your dog, your like, your family? How do you make time for that? You're a superwoman. How do you do it? Tell us your secret right now. I demand it.
It's only going to get harder because, yeah, I'm expecting my first child. Yeah, congratulations. This summer. Thank you. So who knows? You might have to check back with me then. I might not be so balanced. And look, it's always a struggle, right? I mean, it's always tough to balance career and family and to prioritize and make sure you're giving enough attention to everything. And I think that all you can do is the best you can. And it's just about making time for your work. And sometimes for me, that's in the morning, maybe at night, my fiance and I are going to have plans, or maybe we have a big weekend plan. So then I'll make sure I do extra work the day before. I think it's all about being as adaptive as you can and, you know, as willing to maybe sacrifice some other things. Maybe it means I have a bunch of Better Call Sauls piling up on my DVR. But I think having a schedule and really planning things out, I think that all really helps to be really organized, and you're forced into it essentially.
Yeah, because I wonder, because I know with TV schedules, TV shows and writers, you guys are in the room. Like, I feel like it's 24/7. Let's be real.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I feel like you guys work like around the clock, and it's really insane. I don't know how you have time for anything. I don't even know how you have time to eat, like, let alone that. So it's just, for me, it just boggles my mind how you're able to, I guess that's what you said. That's why over the weekends you have time with your fiance, but I guess it's hard during the weekday. And I'm not even sure what your fiance does, but if he were to do something in the same field, like, that would be nearly impossible to meet up. Even like, obviously you're together, you're living together and whatnot, but it's hard because you go home and the other person's tired. They're already knocked out and sleeping. Or when you're finally home, maybe they're not home yet. And that's tough because in the end of the day, it's like you're doing all this also because it's for the family too. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to lose that along the way with success, you know? So right. It's so important to invest in your home, invest in your family, invest in your loved ones. And I think it's crucial to make time for them.
Yeah.
And that's really cool that it sounds like you guys are pretty committed to setting the weekends to yourselves. And
sometimes, you know, he's a visual effects supervisor and,
oh gosh,
you know,
so that's busy as hell too.
So busy. Oh, he has some really bad hours. We just try to make sure we don't have bad hours at the same time. And sometimes either or both of us do have to work on the weekends. And, you know, on 30 Rock, we wrote on the weekends, certainly sometimes. And sometimes you're on a show and you're off on script on the weekends, or you just look for the pockets where you can. And if you make something sacred, you try to work around. So it's like you try to make sure you're there for the important events and that you follow through on your word and your commitments as much as you can. But look, these jobs are all crazy. You know, it's like, it's not a normal life. It's not a 9-to-5 type job. And the payoff is really great if you love what you do, but it's not about getting home in time for dinner every night, unfortunately. But look, people do it and they have a million kids and a million different priorities and people make it work and other people inspire me. And it's something that I ask my friends about who've been married longer and have kids and this and that, you know, I ask them how they do it. And I think it really comes down to communication and being organized from what I've gathered, but we'll see.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. Thank you for that. Thank you for sharing that. I know it's personal, but I appreciate that. And it's super inspiring just to kind of keep everybody grounded and remind them what really is important at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So that was really sweet of you to share that. So now I want to wrap it up real quick. I want to just ask you two more questions. Second to last one. What are some small manageable steps that you can recommend or advise our listeners to get them closer towards their goals of becoming a TV writer or just a writer overall?
I mean, I guess the most important thing is to write, right?
as much as you can. I guess
so. That's huge, you know? And a lot of people advise doing it at the same time every day and doing it every single day. And I can't say that I've honestly stuck to that. I feel like sometimes my schedule changes and I have to write at night and other times I'm writing in the morning. But there is an advantage to that of having a real routine. So if you can manage that, I think that's great. And, you know, if you can't write every day, then just try to find something else that you can do for your craft. And like I said, maybe that's reading an article or maybe, you know, just thinking about an idea while you're serving coffee. I used to do a lot of that when I was an assistant. I couldn't necessarily write all day, but I was thinking about my script, you know, when I didn't have to focus on being an assistant. So I feel like there are ways where you can always be moving your thing forward a little bit. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah. And now last question, Colleen, sure. What are some books that you can recommend to us or movies that you think would help writers specifically?
First book definitely is Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott. I love mm-hmm. that book so much. And mm-hmm. it's just this lovely reflection on writing. And she's very honest in her experience and the challenges that writing brings. And a lot of it is learning to write without judgment and removing some of the perfectionism from the process. And it's just great. So I feel like if you're a writer, that you have to read it. And it's also a good book to reread. You know, I keep it near my desk. And sometimes when I really get stuck, I just read a chapter and I feel inspired. You know, she feels like a comrade and someone who is struggling through it as well. Another book I love is The Artist's Way. I feel very LA saying that. It feels like it's taken on some kind of like flaky life. It's like The Artist's Way, you know, but it's actually incredibly helpful. And
it works.
Yeah, it really works. And I did it for the first time with a bunch of other friends. We met once a week. We did all of the activities. We were really thorough about it. We did our morning pages, you know, so I advise if you do it to really commit to doing it. And another part of that book is like Bird by Bird, learning to let go of being perfect and learning to write that first draft or take that class or do that painting. Like just the idea that it doesn't all have to be exactly what you want it to be in the end. You're starting out. It's okay to make mistakes. And it's also just very inspiring and encourages you to look at art and the world in a different way. So yeah, those are two books that I think are really helpful.
Thank you. And I know you mentioned one earlier in the conversation as well. So I'll have all these three books in the show notes for your page. It's easier for listeners to just click on it and they know where to get it. So Colleen, you've been so awesome.
Oh,
thank
cool.
you so much.
Fun. You're fantastic. This was
oh
great.
My gosh. You, thank you so much for sharing all of that. It's been so helpful. Like I'm telling you, I feel like I already feel so pumped. I'm like, I just want to get off and just start pounding away on this laptop right now. But Colleen, I'm going to let you go because you were so sweet to give us over an hour of your time. So again, thank you for such an awesome interview. And there were so many actionable steps for us and really grounding advice too.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me. And it was great to talk to you.
Hey, Storyteller Tribe. I hope you loved Colleen's episode as much as I loved chatting with her. If you'd like to thank Colleen or want to hear about the latest TV show she's working on, be sure to find her Twitter at McGinnis Call. That's McGinnisCOLL. A very heartfelt thank you to Colleen for being so generous with her time and for all of her actionable tips and advice. For links to the books and resources that were brought up in Colleen's episode, be sure to head over to Colleen's show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Colleen McGinnis. And thank you guys again so much for joining me on this journey and listening to episode 2. I want to see you guys moving forward in your careers, so let me know how this episode helps you. And if there are any questions you'd like for me to ask future guests, make sure to let me know on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And you can find me at 88cupsoftea.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!